The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 3rd, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar today, two oral arguments. We're here in our first matter. That is A20-1507, Adam Scheck versus Kelly Fuels, Inc. Counsel, before we begin, I'm going to ask you to mute your microphone if you're not speaking. The marshal will be showing a running clock of your time. Please keep an eye on the clock. I don't see that. There we go. Thank you very much. Please identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument for the record, because these matters are being recorded. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Okay, go ahead, counsel.
I'm sorry for the technical difficulties here. Howard Bolter, good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Howard Bolter. I represent the relator, Stacey Adam Scheck, in this matter. We're here on an unemployment compensation appeal. Ms. Adam Scheck did not engage in the misconduct that resulted in her termination. The person who engaged in the misconduct was her husband, not Ms. Adam Scheck. So the decision of the ALJ should be reversed because she did not engage in any employment misconduct.
Mr. Bolter, can I jump in here real quick just to be clear? If I understand your argument accurately, as you've just described it, you're not contesting at all the conclusion that the conduct was in fact misconduct. That is, if your client in fact engaged in the conduct that the ULJ's decision is supported.
I think if she had engaged in some of those texts and the email that was sent, then yes, I would say that that would have been misconduct, but the other texts did not. So factually, I think the facts here are important and need to be highlighted. Just generally, she was hired as a clerk, as an accounts receivable clerk on November 29th, 2019. She suffers from underlying medical conditions, which made her more susceptible to COVID. And as everybody knows, at that time, COVID was just hitting. This was just in March of 2020 when the lockdown had just started. So she had justifiable concerns and was particularly vulnerable. Before her termination, she never had any discipline or warning, certainly nothing about texting, nor was she aware of any texting, that texting was not allowed. So the incidents leading up to her termination began on March 20th, 2020. At 7:52 p.m., she sent a text to her supervisor, Valerie Amsden, and the president of the company, Dan Kelly, regarding pay cuts. Ms. Amsden responded at 8:44 with words to the effect that this is something that she or Dan, the president, were more than willing to discuss on Monday, but by text is not appropriate and there's more to the situation than you are hearing. Mr. Kelly also called her and explained the pay cuts and explained why an individual was under quarantine, because there was some concern there too. Up to that point, he had never said that texting was not allowed or that she could be disciplined or terminated for texting. He did indicate at the end of the call that he did not appreciate the late night text, but but he never said that she could be terminated or disciplined for it. And Ms. Adamscheck does not recall him saying, "Don't text him," and thought he indicated that he would be talking to her on Monday.
Mr. Bolter, can I ask a question regarding that last point that you just made? Are you arguing that the employer was required to give her notice that she could have been terminated for texting in order for it to be employment misconduct? I don't read your brief in that manner, but I just want to be clear on that point.
I don't think they're obligated to say that, but it would certainly have sent a message to her, okay, I better stop, because there was no rules or other written regulations surrounding it. It was just his comment that evening. So
then If that's the case, whether or not your client was on notice that inappropriate text messages would be considered misconduct really has no bearing on the outcome of this appeal, right? Recognizing that the warning is not required for the conduct to be construed as employee misconduct.
Well, I think she needs to know that the conduct she's engaging in could be a violation of some expectations that the employer has, some legitimate expectations that I don't think it was very clear that they said it wasn't appreciated at the time. Did that mean that the next one would result in a termination or discipline? That's the trouble I'm having with their comments about this. It wasn't very clear. It's like, okay, I don't appreciate it, but you might not appreciate criticism either. And if someone criticized the employer, is that employment misconduct? I don't think so. I mean,
this idea that the notice would be necessary for it to be construed as misconduct is a nuance that I didn't gather from your brief.
Well, it might not have been specifically stated in the brief. And so to that extent, I'm not saying a notice is required. But I think it is from the brief. I think the gist of the brief's content on that part was that she didn't really know that it would result in disciplinary action. I think that's the point of the brief. There's no I don't think I'm saying that they need to require that it has to be done, but I think the gist of it is she didn't really know. She didn't understand that it was going to be that it could result in some adverse action.
Counsel, I read the substance of your brief or your primary argument to be that the unemployment law judge erred because it made credibility findings that were adverse to your client. Is that your argument?
My argument is that the substantial evidence did not support the judge's findings and nor the credibility findings. I mean, she made credibility findings sort of in the face of evidence totally to the contrary. I mean, I understand she's weighing credibility, but there was really nothing to weigh. There was two people saying she didn't make these texts, she sent these texts, and the employer saying, I ultimately fired her because of an email from her husband. So these credibility findings that the employer's testimony is more believable, just it flies in the face of the testimony itself.
And are you saying that it's the substantial evidence is because there was more than one witness that testified and consistent with your client's version of events and only one witness that testified on behalf of the employer? Or what's the basis of the, I mean, there is evidence in the record that could support the unemployment law judge's findings.
Well, for instance, I think the first part of that question, no. I mean, just because two witnesses are testifying in favor of my client doesn't mean that that's automatic credibility. I would agree with that. But when you show those two people's testimony, highlighting one finding that the judge made, a credibility finding that Ms. Adams sent the texts. I mean, the evidence shows that she didn't send the text, but she's obviously believing the employer's version that she sent the text because it was coming from the same phone. But
yeah, I mean, and the ULJ also said that the employer's version of events was more credible because it was more straightforward and direct and more likely. So what I'm searching for is some authority for us to second guess that evaluation of the evidence.
Well, there is one portion of the evidence where she says it's more believable and it hangs together better. That's what essentially the judge is saying. But there's one part, and she points out one part where the text, there's confusion in the text. And it's sort of a critical point here where my client texts Ms. Amsden at 6:17. And then the next text is Ms. Amsden responding about her her father, Vern, and the test result. The next one is the husband stepping in, saying bullshit. And then there's a bunch of, there's some quick succession where he doesn't know who he's talking to. He says, you know, and Val never responded. And he was texting Val. And that part was found to be, they found the employer's version to be more believable because I don't know why, because it made more sense to me that he didn't know who he was texting because he had taken over her phone and started texting. So that's an example of why I think the credibility finding saying that it's automatically the text from Ms. Adamczyk just because it's from her phone don't make sense. And
Mr. Balter, didn't the unemployment law judge also consider kind of the substance of the text and the context of the text, not just that it came from her phone, in making the credibility determination?
I would hope that that's what they were doing, but to me, in that particular transaction, no, because it's clear. I mean, Ms. Adamczyk was texting with Amsden, then the husband takes over, and it doesn't make sense anymore. He says bullshit, and then he says, you know, but Val's never responded, and that's who Ms. Adamczyk was texting with, is Val. He didn't know that, apparently, and said, Val's not responding, and she says, what do you mean? This is Val. So I don't think that was taken into account, or it was misconstrued somehow to but the judge clearly, I think, misconstrued that portion of it, because...
Well, except that as I read the exchange, it was bullshit, and then Amsden said, excuse me, and Adamczyk said she did not even respond to me. So how does that indicate the husband was sending the text?
Well, she did not even respond. I mean, so first of all, she did not even respond to me. It shows there's a misunderstanding of who this person is texting with. Ms. Adamczyk sends it to Val. And then the husband steps in and says, she didn't even respond to me, referring to Val. And then Val responds, well, what do you mean? This, you know, it's Val. So that suggests to me, at least, that he was responding on her behalf or trying to and doing a bad job of it. And that's why, to me, it's confused, and it makes sense that he took over the phone at that point because it doesn't make any sense any longer. He's acting inappropriately by saying bullshit, where Ms. Adamczyk hadn't done anything like that up to that point. And then says, but she's not responding to me. She, meaning Val, who that's who he was texting with and had just responded. So that's the part I'm having trouble understanding, how that can be found to be Ms. Adamczyk's. You know, she wasn't having any difficulty communicating with Ms. Amsden. And then he steps in and is, and confuses the thing by thinking he's not talking to her, and she has to clarify that point. So that's the part that I'm having trouble with, that part, that credibility finding. Not to mention, Your Honors, the evidence generally about his conduct, particularly the email. There's no dispute about the email that he sent that and that they terminated her for it. I mean, there's no dispute about the fact that she didn't authorize that document to be sent. He sent it.
Mr. Balter, how convinced are you that your interpretation of the ambiguous facts are the only interpretation of the facts?
Well, I'm convinced of that because I believe my client, and I believe the testimony of her husband. I mean, her husband acted inappropriately.
No, I understand you believe that, but I'm asking from our perspective, from an objective standpoint, since we have to, I mean, you're asking us to do a pretty extraordinary thing, not just believe that you're correct, but believe that you're so correct that there's absolutely no other reasonable interpretation of the ambiguous exchanges.
I mean, Your Honor, could there be another interpretation? Yes, I'm not going to go and say there's absolutely no way it could be interpreted another way. I mean, that would be hard to say about a lot of things.
But isn't that enough? I mean, that's the difficult thing. I mean, if you're asking us to substitute our credibility assessment for the ULJs, I mean, maybe we would agree with you if you were arguing this to us as a matter of fact. But we're not reviewing the evidence. We're reviewing the ULJ's reasonableness in interpreting the evidence to see whether or not there's some substantial evidence, which is basically any evidence that might support the reasonable conclusion that your client is the one who sent the text messages.
Well, I don't think there was substantial evidence to support that. I mean, I don't think there was substantial evidence. I think that the testimony and the evidence that was presented not substantial enough to support her credibility finding. I think it was the other way around.
Mr. Bolter, given the extremely deferential standard of review with regard to the unemployment law judge's credibility determination, if we conclude that that determination is entitled to deference, did the unemployment law judge err in concluding that there was employment misconduct if we accept the credibility determination by the ULJ?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You're arguing, I think, that the unemployment law judge, I'm sorry, Judge Frisch, can I continue?
Of course.
I think you're arguing that the unemployment law judge erred in making credibility determinations regarding your client's testimony and her husband's testimony. If we conclude that we have to defer to the credibility determinations as made by the unemployment law judge, does the record support the conclusion of the unemployment law judge that there was employment misconduct?
I would say no, it doesn't. I think that the evidence that came out supports the fact that she didn't engage in misconduct, and that it was her husband, and that's why she was fired. But, so Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. I don't, if there's more questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I do know that I'm out of time.
Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal if you choose to use it. Ms. Phillips?
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent the respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So this case is about credibility and fact-finding. So if, as the relator contends, her husband sent the majority of the text messages on the two nights in question, DEED agrees that this would not be employment misconduct. But the ULJ made a detailed credibility finding, determining that it was more likely that it was the relator who sent those messages. And her findings are supported by the record. So the ULJ kind of sets out three reasons for her finding that it was the relator who sent the messages. And I'll take you through those three reasons. So first, the ULJ reasoned that the text messages were written from the relator's perspective and not from someone else's. So for the relator's version of events to be true, her husband would have had to have taken her phone without her knowing it just after the first text was sent each of the two evenings at issue and pretended to be her. And based on what the messages say and the context of the discussions leading up to the messages, this is unlikely. So the text messages that she denied sending on March 20th were about her hours and her pay. And Daniel Kelly testified that he spoke to her that night and she was upset about her hours being cut. So it makes sense that shortly after that conversation, she would send text messages about that. On March 21st, it does seem like one or two of the messages were meant to go to someone else. They were about the relator's conversation with Valerie Amsden. The other messages were related to concerns about Vernon Kelly's test results. And this is a topic that the relator admitted that she was concerned about, that she had talked to her coworker about. So as the ULJ reasoned, it's just not likely that the relator's husband would have sent these messages pretending to be her. And then as the ULJ noted, relator's husband did send an email that night and he identified himself. He wrote it from his own point of view. And the email is, you know, quite different from the text messages. They seem like they were written by different people. Second, the ULJ reason.
Ms. Phillips, before the email, there were text exchanges that were written in the plural wouldn't that indicate that at least there's a possibility that someone other than the relator was sending the text messages? I mean, it would make sense that she would write I, and it would also make sense that her husband would write we. Why would she write we in the context of text messages?
Sure. I interpret we to refer to the relator and her coworker, Megan. There's testimony, Ms. Amston testified that Megan sent an email copying the relator on the Friday before the weekend, saying that, have you heard about the test results? And Ms. Amston replied to that email, I will let you know as soon as we get the results. And so that was sent to both Megan and to Amston. Daniel Kelly also testified that he spoke to Megan after the fact, and Megan said that she was texting with the relator during this weekend. So both the relator and her coworker were concerned about the test results. They had both asked about them. So I interpret the we to be relator and Megan. The second point of reasoning that the ULJ makes is that the Amston and Daniel Kelly got the messages from the phone number that they'd used for the relator in the past, and they both testified that they had no reason to think they weren't from the relator, kind of based on the series of events. So Valerie Amston testified that when she spoke to the relator on March 21st, she said, I'm calling you about the text messages that you've been sending me. They're not appropriate, and I need you to stop. Amston testified that the relator did not question what text messages she was referring to. She didn't say that she didn't send them. Amston testified that she had no reason to believe that they would have come from anybody else. And Daniel Kelly, kind of his testimony echoes that. And then finally, the ULJ does reason that it was more likely that the relator was slurring her words because she was intoxicated. The ULJ bases this finding on testimony from Daniel Kelly and Valerie Amston regarding their conversations with the relator that night, what she sounded like, that she sounded different. And the fact that she was intoxicated makes it more likely that she would have sent those messages herself those two nights. So, yes.
Would you please respond to Mr. Bolter's argument, at least during the oral argument portion of the appeal, that your client was not previously informed that her text messages would be construed as employee misconduct, as it bears upon the ULJ's ultimate finding of employee misconduct?
Sure. So both Daniel Kelly and Valerie Amston told Relator to stop texting them about this. Daniel Kelly called her on the phone and told her, don't text. If you want to talk about this, call me. Text. Tone gets lost. We'll talk about it. Valerie Amston, we have her text message in the record to Relator saying, by text is not appropriate. This is something that I'm more than willing to discuss with you on Monday. So they both communicated their expectation that she stopped texting them. Valerie Amston, again, the next night said, I'm eating dinner. I'm not appreciating the way you're texting me. And she continued to text her after that. So there were three communications where the employer saying, stop texting me. So they knew she knew the expectation was to stop texting, and she intentionally continued to text after that. So she didn't get a warning. Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Is it your position then that any after hours text after she had the warning, any additional text after hours would constitute employment misconduct?
It certainly could. The case law, the relevant case law provides that if a request from the employer is reasonable and does not impose an unreasonable burden on the employee, the employee's intentional refusal to abide by that is employment misconduct. And there is case law where a single refusal constitutes employment misconduct. So it would be consistent with the case law for, a single communication to be employment misconduct, it leaves more room to argue that it wasn't a serious violation. You know, here it kind of becomes serious because it's repeated, and also because some of the text messages are inappropriate, disrespectful. So, I mean, that adds to the seriousness of the violation, but I think it is consistent with the case law. One case that comes to mind, I'm not sure if I cited this in the brief, but it's a McGowan case, which is the site is 420 Northwest 2D 593. In that case, the relator refused to pick up the employer's personal prescription, saying it's not in my job duties. And the Minnesota Supreme Court affirmed that finding that that was employment misconduct, saying, you know, employers should be able to expect employees to follow their instructions if it's a reasonable instruction. So I believe that it could be employment misconduct, just one communication.
And just following up on Judge Ross's question, then, there isn't any case law that you're aware of that requires notice to the employee that they could be terminated before they can be terminated for employment misconduct?
No, I'm not aware of that case law. I believe there are a number of cases where there's no such explicit warning or statement of what the consequence is going to be. You know, not employers follow disciplinary policies. Not all employers give written warnings or say, if you do this, you're going to be discharged. You know, the standard is whether it was a serious violation of the employer's reasonable expectations. And so that doesn't require any kind of wording by the employer or any kind of warnings. So I don't believe that that's required to find employment misconduct.
When was the first time that the relator was advised not to send text messages?
The first time was when I believe Daniel Kelly spoke to her on the phone before Valerie Amsden texted her that it was not appropriate. So I believe the first time she was told not to text was when Daniel Kelly called her on March 20th. And then after that, Valerie Amsden texted her. I believe it was shortly after that. She texted at 8:44 that evening saying by text is not appropriate. So that was the first time I believe the employer's witnesses admit in the hearing that they hadn't told her before that. So it was the first time she was given that instruction, but she was given it twice on the 20th and then again on the 21st. So she had kind of three times where the employers were telling her to stop doing that. And just kind of briefly to touch on the email, you know, while her husband's email may have been one reason for the discharge, the record supports that that the relator's conduct in texting her supervisor after being told not to was also a reason. So while the email certainly may have been the last straw, her conduct before that is enough to be employment misconduct. And the ULJ's decision is consistent with the Deering case cited by the relator in her brief where the husband sabotages the truck. Here, the ULJ is not finding that the email was employment misconduct. She's focused just on the relator's conduct in sending the text messages. So I don't have a lot of other points to make. If there are no other questions from the panel, I will conclude that the ULJ's findings of fact are supported by substantial evidence in the record. The ULJ's credibility determination is detailed, it's supported by the record, and the ULJ correctly determined that the relator's conduct was employment misconduct. So Deed respectfully requests that the court affirm the ULJ's decision. All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right. Mr. Bolter, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. You're muted, sir. All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think I'll need all of it, but I would like to make a few points. First, one thing I didn't get to that goes to credibility in the texting issue, Ms. Adamczyk apologized after she was terminated and said she, to Amsden, and via text, ironically, but she did send these texts to her saying she was, you know, she wouldn't disrespect their family like that, referring to these previous texts, and that she respected them. I mean, it made, that makes sense given she didn't send the text, and apologizing had no benefit for her. She didn't gain anything. She'd already been fired. She was just sort of clearing up what was, you know, eventually what was a bad misunderstanding due to her husband's inappropriate text. So I wanted to raise that point. Also, this finding of intoxication is troubling because,
and there were some other things that preceded those, that text from Ms. Adamczyk. I mean, husband goes to the place of business, the police are called, she sends another text message saying, I have too many people telling me what to do and how to feel, I need to ignore them and keep moving forward. I mean, it wasn't as though she apologized and said she didn't do it out of the blue. There were some things that happened in between that.
Agreed. And I just think that that underscores that her husband was kind of unhinged. I mean, the guy was doing stuff and she had no control over it. That seemed clear from the evidence of the hearing, the testimony from Ms. Amson about him screaming at her in the background and swearing in the background, so much so that it scared her, even testifying at the hearing about it, where he at the hearing was also acting inappropriately. So, I mean, those things go to,
I mean, what about her text denying that she sent that, or saying that the husband sent the email, but not saying that the husband sent the text messages at that time? There were some other text messages in between that.
Right. And I don't have an explanation for that. I mean, I think that the evidence was clear at the hearing who sent the serious violation text. Because if you back those out, if you back that bullshit strand out of there, I think this becomes, maybe it's a violation, but it's not a serious one. And could they terminate her for it? Sure, they could. But is it employment misconduct? No. I think you back that key text out of there, and this whole thing changes. But it was in there, and I was saying that what troubled me at this in the findings was the fact that there was a finding of intoxication. I mean, these are not, there's no sobriety test being conducted by the judge or by the parties. I mean, this was someone talking on the phone saying, I thought she was intoxicated because she was upset and was slurring her words. Ms. Adamczyk said she wasn't. The husband testified he was. But, and then to use that intoxication as the basis for additional credibility determinations that the judge was making, you know, because she was intoxicated, it's more likely than not that she engaged in these inappropriate texts. Well, you know, it's kind of like fruit from the poisonous tree. I mean, if you're going to find she's intoxicated, then this other stuff follows. But she had no basis to say she was intoxicated. And really, neither did the employer. I mean, they'd never seen her intoxicated. They heard her talking on the phone. She was slurring her words. I mean, she might have been really upset. Her husband was screaming at her in the background.
Right, but the employer has the benefit of observing her in the workplace when presumably she's not under the influence of alcohol. And why wouldn't there be some basis for the ULJ to trust the observation of a third party who now has some opportunity to contrary? Maybe the ULJ can't. But the employer can hear and compare the demeanor and language and intonation and everything else. Why wouldn't that at least be some basis to support the credibility determination of the ULJ?
Well, maybe it's some shred of basis, but I don't think the employer was taking into account, or the ULJ was taking into account the whole situation, because there was screaming and yelling going on in the background. I mean, it sounded like quite a volatile situation going on. And I just don't think that the context was taken into account by the ULJ when she made the decision. Thank you, Your Honors.
Right. Thank you very much, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement, issue an order with it, or an opinion within statutory time period.